which a stranger handed the subjects either a mug of hot coffee or a cup of iced coffee. The subjects were asked to read about a hypothetical character and asked to describe the character's true nature. The results were astonishing. Those who were given the hot coffee described the character as warm and generous, while the iced coffee holders described him as cold and selfish. In another study at the University of Washington, women of Asian descent were given a mathematics test. Before the test, they took a brief questionnaire. If they were asked to list their ethnicity, the women scored 20% higher on the math test. But for those who were asked to fill in gender instead of ethnicity, the simple act of writing that they were female produced significantly lower scores. That's the power of priming in the form of cultural conditioning. It affects our unconscious patterns, shrinking or unleashing our true potential. We can make use of this phenomenon by developing a simple 10-minute daily practice to prime our minds and hearts for gratitude, the emotion that eliminates anger and fear. Remember, if you're grateful, you can't be angry simultaneously. You can't be fearful and grateful simultaneously. It's impossible. I begin every day with a minimum of 10 minutes. I stop, close my eyes, and for approximately 3 minutes reflect on what I'm grateful for. The wind on my face, the love in my life, the opportunities and the blessings I experience. I don't just focus on big things. I make a point not only to notice, but also to deeply feel an appreciation for the little things that make life rich. For the next 3 minutes, I ask for health and blessings for all of those I love, know, and have the privilege to touch. My family, friends, clients, and the stranger I may meet today. Sending love, blessings, and gratitude and wishes for abundance to all people. As corny as it sounds, it's the real circle of life. I spend the remaining time on what I call my three to thrive, three things that I want to accomplish. I envision them as if they were already achieved and feel a sense of celebration and gratitude for them. Priming is an important gift to yourself. If you did it for 10 days, you'd be hooked. Here's a link to get you started. TonyRobbins.com. The simple practice is important because a lot of people say they're grateful, but they don't take time to be grateful. It's so easy in life to lose track of the beauty and grace of what we already have. If we don't consciously do something each day to plant the right seeds in our mind, then the weeds of life, frustration, anger, stress, loneliness, tend to creep in. You don't have to plant weeds. They grow automatically. My teacher, Jim Rohn, taught me a simple principle. Every day, stand guard at the door of your mind, and you alone decide what thoughts and beliefs you let into your life, for they will shape whether you feel rich or poor, cursed or blessed. In the end, if we're going to truly be happy, we have to get outside of ourselves. The human mind is an amazing thing. It's a survival mechanism, so it tends to look for what's wrong, what to avoid, what to look out for. You may have evolved, but your brain is still a 2-million-year-old structure, and if you want to be fulfilled and happy, that's not its first priority. You have to take control of it, and the fastest way to do that, besides priming, is to step into the highest of the 6 human needs, the 2 spiritual needs that fulfill human beings, growth and contribution. The core reason that I believe we all have a desire to grow is because when we do, we have something to give. That's where life has its deepest meaning. Getting might make you feel good for a moment, but nothing beats the nirvana of having something to give that you know deeply touches someone or something beyond yourself. Everyone can be great because everyone can serve. Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. If it's really true that giving is what makes us feel fully alive, then perhaps the ultimate test of this theory is what is life like for those willing to give their lives for something they believe in. One of my greatest heroes of the last century was civil rights leader Martin Luther King, Jr. Recently, his eldest son and namesake, Martin Luther King III, was in Fiji for my Date with Destiny event. I had the opportunity of sharing with him how much his dad inspired me because he lived his life on pure passion. He knew what he was made for. Even as a child, I remember hearing his words, A man who has not found something he will die for is not fit to live. Real wealth is unleashed in your life the moment you find something you care so deeply for, you will give it your all, even your life if necessary. This is the moment in which you will have truly escaped the tyranny of your own mind, your own fears, your own sense of limitation. A big order, I know. But I also know that most of us would give our lives for our children, our parents, or our spouses. Those who have found a mission that possesses them have discovered a wealth of energy and meaning that has no match. The wealth of passion. You've probably heard of the Pakistani teenager Malala Yousafzai. She was shot in the head by Taliban terrorists because she had the audacity to insist that girls have the right to go to school. A bullet pierced her eye socket and bounced around her skull, nearly killing her. Miraculously, it missed her brain. Malala survived her horrific injuries and has become an international activist for the empowerment of girls and women. The man who shot her remains free, and the Taliban still threatens to kill her. But she openly defies them. In a speech before the United Nations on her 16th birthday, Malala said she has no fear. They thought that the bullet would silence us, but they failed. And out of this silence came thousands of voices. The terrorists thought that they would change my aim and stop my ambitions, but nothing changed in my life except this. Weakness, fear, and hopelessness died. Strength, fervor, and courage was born. In an interview with Malala, CNN's Christiane Amanpour asked the young woman if she feared for her life. Malala replied, "The thing is, they can kill me. They can only kill Malala. But it does not mean that they can kill my cause as well. My cause of education, my cause of peace, and my cause of human rights. My cause of equality will still be surviving. They only can shoot a body, but they cannot shoot my dreams." This 16-year-old young woman has mastered those three decisions. She's focused on what matters. She's found a mission beyond herself that gives her life meaning, and her actions are fearless. While we might not be called to put our lives on the line like Malala, we can all choose to live fearlessly, passionately, and with boundless gratitude. So let's finish our wealth-building journey together with the most important lesson of all, the final secret.
Chapter 7.3, The Final Secret. We make a living by what we get. We make a life by what we give. Winston Churchill. As we take these final steps of our journey together, I want to invite you to think about, what are you most passionate about in this world? What do you care for most deeply? What excites you? What legacy would light you up? What could you do today that would make you proud? What action could you take that would be a signal to your own spirit that your life is being well lived? And if you were truly inspired, what would you like to create or give, and to whom? All these questions bring us closer to the final secret of true wealth. But here's the deal. Part of the key that I'm going to share with you now will seem counterintuitive. You know why? Because we spend all this time talking about how to master money, how to save, how to invest, how to build a critical mass that'll ultimately create freedom and increase the quality of your life. But at the same time, we've all been taught that money can't buy happiness. In fact, one study attests that most people believe that if their income was to double, that their happiness would also double. But the study's findings prove that in reality, people who went from earning $25,000 a year to more than $55,000 per year reported only a 9% increase in happiness. Additionally, one of the most widely quoted studies in the subject tells us that once you make a solid middle-class salary, about $75,000 a year in America, earning more money doesn't make a real measurable difference in the person's level of happiness. So what's the point, you might ask? The truth is, more recent studies have proven that money can make us happier. Scientists have shown that, quote, spending as little as $5 a day can significantly change your happiness. How so? Well, it's not the amount of money you spend, but how you spend it, how you decide to spend it that really matters. Quote, everyday spending choices unleash a cascade of biological and emotional effects that are detectable right down to your saliva, end quote, reports Harvard's Elizabeth Dunn and Michael Norton in their brilliant 2013 book, Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. They say, quote, while having more money can provide all kinds of wonderful things, from tastier food to safer neighborhoods, its real power comes not in the amount, but how we spend it, end quote. They've scientifically proven that there are many different ways you can spend your money that will actually increase your happiness significantly. I won't reveal them all here. I'll leave for you to pick up their book. But three of the most important are, number one, investing in experiences. See, if you spend your money on travel or learning a new skill or taking a new course, I'll give you a hint, I know a good one you might want to try out. But if you invest in things that are experiences, all the research shows that that gives you so much more joy than acquiring more possessions. What's the second way you can increase your happiness? By the way you spend money? By spending it by buying time for yourself. Listen, that's the one thing that's as scarce as money, or more scarce for many of us, is time. See, whenever you can outsource a more dreaded task, like scrubbing toilets or cleaning gutters, money can transform the way we spend our time, and that frees us up to pursue our passions. And when you're spending more time with your passions and less things that are drudgery, happiness increases geometrically. But can you guess what the greatest thing you can do with your money to massively increase your happiness? Yep, that's right. Number three, investing in others. That's right. Giving your money away actually makes us really happy. Now, most people don't believe that. I go, yeah, easy for some rich billionaire, maybe you, but not for me. No, I'm talking about for anybody. In fact, the research shows that the more you give to others, the happier you are. And ironically, the more you have, the more you're able to give. It's a virtuous cycle. Dunn and Norton demonstrate through their own scientific studies that people get more satisfaction spending money on others than they get spending on themselves. And you know what? The benefits extend not only to subjective well-being, but, quote, to actual objective health. In other words, giving makes you both happier and healthier. According to the authors, this phenomenon spans continents and cultures. It's not how you're brought up. It's a human thing. Rich countries and poor, people on the highest and lowest income groups, young people and old, from a Canadian college student purchasing a scarf for her mother to a Ugandan woman buying life-saving malaria medication for a friend. In fact, the data shows that the size of the gift really doesn't matter. In one of the studies, the authors handed participants either $5 or $20 to spend by the end of the day. Half of the people were told to buy something for themselves. The others were instructed to use the money to help somebody else. Quote, that evening, people who had been assigned to spend the money on someone else reported significantly happier moods over the course of the day than did the people who were assigned to spend the money on themselves, they wrote. The author's colleague, psychologist Laura Acknin of Simon Fraser University, conducted another study in which she handed out $10 Starbucks gift cards to her subjects. Some were instructed to go to Starbucks alone and use the card for themselves. Another group were told use the gift card to take a person out for coffee. A third group were told give the card away to someone else, but they weren't allowed to go to Starbucks with that person. And finally, the fourth group were taught that they should take another person with them to Starbucks, but only use the card on themselves and not for the other person. Well, you can guess what happened. At the end of the day, which subjects do you think reported being happiest? You're right if you picked the ones that were there in Starbucks where they treated someone else to the cup of coffee. Because according to the article, people are happiest when they connect with those people they help and they see how their generous actions have made a difference. I can tell you through my own foundation, feeding people, not as the giver, going and delivering the food, even though you bought it, and seeing the look on people's faces, seeing how their life changed, is what's made people become addicted to my Basker Brigade through the Anthony Robbins Foundation, and what grew us from me feeding two families and then four, then eight, to now feeding 4 million people a year. Now look, the happiness we feel from helping others is not only more intense, but it's proven to last longer. Who wants happiness for the moment? Why not lasting happiness? When I brought up this topic of money and happiness in my interview with renowned behavioral economics expert Dan Ariely, he told me, quote, if you ask people what would make you happy, buying something for yourself or buying something for someone else, they say, oh, something for myself, but it's just not true. Research shows that when people buy something for themselves, they get happy for a few minutes or usually at most a few hours. But if they buy even a small gift for somebody else, the giver's happiness lasts minimum to the end of the day, and often this happiness can carry over for days, or in some cases, even weeks upon end. Dan also told me about, quote, a beautiful experiment in which employees of a certain company were given bonuses in a $3,000 range. Some people got the bonuses to spend on themselves, and some were instructed to give the money away. Guess who was happier? And you go, come on, Tony, not this one's over the edge. $3,000. I'm not giving $3,000 away to some stranger or somebody else in the company. But guess what? Quote, 6 months down the line, the people who gave it away reported being much happier than the group that kept it for themselves, end quote. Dan said, quote, I mean, think about what giving is all about, right? It's an amazing thing that connects you to other people, and there's a cycle of benefits that come from that, end quote. When you give money away, especially if you do something for a stranger versus if you do something for someone you love, the level of multiplied happiness is geometric. It's the equivalent often of doubling, in some cases, tripling a person's salary. In fact, in my own experience, I've witnessed so many amazing things happen when you give. When you get beyond your own survival and your own success mechanisms, and you put yourself in a world where you're living for more than just yourself, then suddenly your fear, your frustration, your pain, and unhappiness just disappear. I truly believe that when we give of ourselves, then life, God, grace, whatever you want to call it, steps in and guides us. Remember, life supports whatever supports more of life. If you're a little skeptical of this, I get it. But let me give you a real practical example about how a young boy's life was reignited after his heart and soul were nearly crushed in the aftermath of that horrific school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. His story of finding purpose and inspiration and a release from pain through the act of giving, I think, will inspire you. A power beyond pain. J.T. Lewis will never forget December 14th, 2012. That morning, a deranged shooter broke into Sandy Hook Elementary School with a death wish for himself and 26 others, including 20 children ranging from ages of 5 to 10. At one point during the rampage, JT's 6-year-old brother Jesse noted the shooter's weapon had jammed and shouted for his classmates to run. That brave little boy saved many lives that morning, but unfortunately not his own. That gunman turned on Jesse and shot him in the head. Imagine the devastation if Jesse was your son or your brother. I had the privilege of meeting 13-year-old JT and his and Jesse's mother, Scarlett, when I flew to Newtown on the first anniversary of the massacre to help a group of survivors cope with the ongoing impact of this devastating tragedy. As I expected, so many of the families were tortured with grief, but I was astonished to talk to JT and learn how his pain and suffering had been transformed through a single interaction with a group of extraordinary Rwandan orphans. These young boys and girls had heard about JT's loss, and they literally reached across the globe to share a message of healing with him. These orphans had all survived one of the worst tragedies in history. I'm sure you remember, in 1994, there was mass genocide in Rwanda that led to the death of as many as 1 million Tutsis who were killed by their Hutu neighbors in nearly 100 days. During a Skype call, one of the girls, Chantel, told JT how sorry she was for the loss of his brother, but she wanted him to know that no one can take away joy and happiness from your life. Only you can do it. The shooter does not have that power unless you give it to him. She then went on to share her own story of how she was only 8 years old when she had been forced to witness the horrendous sight of her parents being hacked to death by men with machetes. Next, the killers turned on her, slashing her neck and throwing her tiny body into a mass grave. Then they buried her beneath the ground, bleeding profusely, and terrified, but still alive and filled with the will to survive, Chantal clawed her way out of the shallow grave and made her way to freedom in the mountains above her village. Hiding in the dark forest, she could look down on the community she once called home. Imagine this, flames everywhere swallowing up houses, and the air echoed with the screams of the people she loved. She lived on grass for a month while she waited for the killing to stop. Certainly, you'd expect a child forced to witness the murder of her own parents would be emotionally scarred for life. One would expect her to live in anger and fear and sadness, but she doesn't. She's a master of the three decisions that shape our lives. As she told JT, quote, I know you don't believe it now, but you can heal immediately and live a happy and beautiful life. It simply requires training yourself every day to be grateful, forgiving, and compassionate. Grateful for what you do have instead of focusing on what you don't. You must forgive the shooter and his family and find a way to serve others, and you will be freed from your pain, she said. Her face was filled with a joy greater than JT could ever imagine. And as bad as his life was, the horror she described was more intense than anything he could conceive. If she could be free of her pain, then so could he, and now was the time. But how would he do it? He decided he must find a way to give back to this young soul who had reached across thousands of miles to send him love in his day of need. Chantel found her reason to live, her passion, her sense of purpose, in deciding to protect, love, and raise some of the younger orphans of the genocide. This became her mission, and it freed her from focusing on herself and any sense of personal loss. Her example of service to others touched JT deeply, and he became obsessed with the idea of giving. He decided that helping to create a better future for this extraordinary girl was his mission, so he began to work day and night to raise money to put her through college. Within several months, this 13-year-old boy was able to Skype back and announce that he had raised $2,100, enough money to send Chantel to college for a year. She was incredibly touched. But like many young people, especially in the third world, university was simply not a practical option for her, especially since she'd already started her own small business as a shopkeeper. And by the way, as you might guess, from a woman with her spirit, she was quite a successful entrepreneur. So in the continued spirit of giving, Chantel passed this amazing gift on to her best friend, Betty, who was another orphan who'd been on the call to encourage JT that day. I was so moved by JT's commitment that I decided on the spot to provide the additional 3 years of college for Betty and to support Chantel by providing her the funding for a new shop and a permanent residence for her and her adopted orphan family. Today, we're all working together to expand the resources available for many more of the 75,000 orphan children who survived genocide. The lesson here is this. Human beings can overcome our pain when we choose to see life's beauty and find a way to give of ourselves. That's where the healing gift comes from. The key is finding something that will inspire you to want to give. That sense of mission, that's the ultimate power in a human being's life. That's when you truly become wealthy. That's when you move from a mere life of enjoyment to a life of joy and meaning. Giving is healing. Of course, giving means more than just giving money. It's also giving your time. It's giving your emotion. It's giving your presence to your kids, to your family, to your husband, to your wife, to your friends, to your associates. Our work is also our gift. Whether that gift is a song, a poem, building a multinational business, serving as a counselor, a healthcare provider, or a teacher, we've all got something to give. In fact, after love, one of the most sacred gifts I believe we can give is our labor. And volunteering your time, giving a unique level of caring, sharing your skills and insights is also a significant form of giving and provides great returns. My friend Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post cites studies in her brilliant new book, Thrive, that show how the act of giving actually improves your physical and your mental health. One example I love in particular is the 2013 study from Britain's University of Exeter Medical School that reveals how volunteering is associated with lower rates of depression, higher rates of reported well-being, and a 22% reduction in death rates. She also writes, quote, volunteering at least once a week yields improvements to well-being tantamount to your salary increasing from $20,000 to $75,000, a more than tripling of your income, all by helping strangers. So what's the final secret to wealth? I think you figured it out. It's that giving in any form builds wealth faster than getting it ever will. It's ironic. I told you it was counterintuitive. See, I don't care how powerful any of us are as individuals, whether you're a business titan, a political leader, a financial mogul, an entertainment icon. The secret to a fulfilled life is not only to do well, but to do good. After all, we all know the story of how society was transformed originally by these magnificently wealthy individuals who woke up one morning and realized life's more than just about me. Being the richest man in the cemetery doesn't matter to me. Going to bed at night saying we've done something wonderful, that's what matters to me. Steve Jobs. Now, before the 19th century, most charity was handled by religious organizations until steel magnate Andrew Carnegie came along. I mean, kings and nobles and the wealthiest families weren't really interested in giving back to their communities for the most part. They just wanted to hang on to their money for themselves and their heirs. Many businessmen shared the same belief, but Carnegie led that group of, quote, robber barons of his era to create philanthropy as we've come to know it in the modern world today. But Carnegie originally was a ruthless businessman. He made steel that built the railroads and the skyscrapers that transformed America, and he had to add value to be profitable, so society benefited and so did he. In his lifetime, he became the richest man in the world, but then came a stage in his life where he'd gotten all the things he'd ever wanted, and then some. He had so much money that he began to realize that money really has very little meaning unless you use it for something beyond yourself. So Carnegie spent the first half of his life accumulating money, and then literally the second half of his life giving it all away. He described his personal transformation in an essay and later a book that's still worth reading. It's called The Gospel of Wealth. In fact, my friend, Nobel Prize winner and Yale economics professor, Dr. Robert Shiller, insists that all of his students read it because he wants them to know that capitalism can be a force for good. Carnegie's essay changed society, and it influenced his peers, and it even challenged the incomprehensible wealth of his greatest rival, John D. Rockefeller. Inspired by his fierce competitive spirit, Rockefeller began to compete, shoveling mountains of money into some of the nation's greatest foundations. Carnegie created a new standard, a standard of measuring your significance not by what you have, but by what you give. His focus was education. In fact, during his lifetime, Carnegie's contributions doubled the number of libraries in the United States, providing so much of the intellectual growth and capital of our society before the internet came into being. Later, our friend Chuck Feeney became a modern Carnegie, giving away almost $7.5 billion of fortune, except he chose to keep quiet about it until very recently. Why did he change? He decided he wanted to inspire others to do the same. By the time I came to meet Chuck, he was 83 in his final stage of his life. He had difficulty speaking for extended periods of time, but in his presence is found an experience more profound than words. In his presence, you feel the power of a life well lived. You can see it in the joy in his eyes, in the smile that flashes so easily for him, and in the kindness that emanates from his heart. Chuck Feeney, in turn, inspired another generation. Many say Ted Turner was the next to reignite the form of large-scale philanthropy with his $1 billion pledge to the United Nations. Since then, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have joined forces to create what's called the Giving Pledge, to inspire the world's wealthy to leave at least half of their fortunes to charity. At last count, more than 120 billionaires have signed up, including some of the ultra-wealthy individuals in this book, such as Ray Dalio, T. Boone Pickens, Sarah Blakely, Carl Icahn, and Paul Tudor Jones. In fact, I think you might find it very interesting to go to givingpledge.org and take a few moments to read some of the moving letters these men and women have left as to why they're giving away half their fortune. T. Boone Pickens told me he'd gotten a bit carried away with philanthropy. He recently given nearly $500 million to his alma mater, Oklahoma State University, bringing his total charitable gifts to over $1 billion. However, recently, he took some losses and it lowered his net worth to $950 million, just shy of a billion that he'd given away. But T-Bone's not concerned. After all, he's only 86 years old. He said, "Don't worry, Tony. I'm planning on earning another $2 billion in the next few years." He feels no sense of loss because the joy he's received from giving is priceless. In modern times, the richest and the most influential men and women in the world have tackled the world's big problems. Carnegie took on education, Bill and Melinda Gates take on scholarship and preventable epidemics, Bono's passion is forgiving the debt that enslaves third world countries, but do you really have to be a billionaire or a rock star to solve the world's greatest problems? Certainly not in today's interconnected world. If you and I work together through the use of technology, we can do a little bit together and still have a giant impact. Swipe out hunger, swipe out disease, swipe out slavery. I'm not sure what your passion is, but one area I personally feel deep empathy for is children and families in need. You need to have ice in your veins not to feel for a child who's suffering. So let's take a minute to look at three of the biggest problems affecting children and their families today, and what immediate concrete steps we could easily take to make a difference, and in a way that we'd feel proud, in a way that would not cause us to suffer or overstretch. The first one is hunger. Who do you think goes to bed hungry each night in the richest country in the world? According to the U.S. Census Bureau, as staggering as it sounds, 1 in 4 American children under the age of 5 lives in poverty. Almost 1 in 10 lives in extreme poverty, which, by the way, is defined as an annual income of $11,746. That's $32 a day for a family of 4 to live on. It's insane. 50 million Americans, including 17 million children, live in what we call food insecure homes. Or as Joel Berg of the New York Coalition Against Hunger told Teresa Riley of Moyers & Company, homes that, quote, don't have enough money to regularly obtain the food they need, homes that are rationing food and skipping meals, where parents are going without food to feed their own children. At the same time this is going on, Congress has cut $8.7 billion out of the annual SNAP benefits, which used to be called food stamps, by the way, eliminating more than a week's worth of meals every month for 500,000 American families. I lived in one of those homes. Ours was one of those families. That's where my passion to make a difference in this area comes from. I know these aren't just statistics. These are human beings who are suffering. I've already shared with you how my life was transformed one Thanksgiving day when I was 11 years old. Again, it wasn't just receiving the food that changed my life. It was the fact that a stranger cared. That simple act had an exponential effect. I've continued to pay that gift forward by feeding 42 million people over the last just under 38 years. The key is, I didn't want to wait until I could handle a huge problem on a large scale. I didn't wait until I was wealthy. I started to tackle the problem when I was just a kid with the little that I had. At first, trust me, it was a financial stretch to just feed two families. But when I became inspired, I doubled my goal to feed four. And the next year it was eight, and then 16. As my companies and influence grew, it became $1 million a year, and then 2 million. Just like investments compound, so do investments in giving. And they provide a much greater reward. The feeling and the privilege that I experienced being in a place where today I'm able to donate 50 million meals and in partnership with you and other people provide maybe 100 million meals is beyond description. There is no word for it. There are no words for it. I was the guy who had to be fed, remember? And now with grace and commitment, it's my honor to feed others and let them know that they're truly cared for and to multiply the good that's been done for me and for my family. There is nothing like the power of the human soul on fire. Look, along the way, caring touched me, and so did books. They transported me from a world of limitation to a life of possibility, because I entered in the minds of the authors. I mean, when you read a book, you think like the author, or if in this case, you hear their voice. You're getting that voice inside of you. So I wanted to make sure that that same author's works, other books that touched me, we could use that same philosophy. So I approached my publisher, Simon & Schuster, and let him know that I wanted not just to feed bodies, but minds as well. And I got them to join me in this mission by donating my simple Change Your Life book called Notes from a Friend. I wrote it to help someone in a tough place to turn their life around with some practical advice and some strategies and inspirational stories. It shows that I was homeless once too and how my life has transformed and how I did it. To match the investment you've made in buying this book, my publisher has pledged to provide a copy of Notes from a Friend to a person in need through my partners at Feeding America. They're the nation's largest network of food banks, and they're considered the most effective charity in the United States for feeding the homeless, and they're going to help us feed not only their bodies, but these people's minds through the book as well. So now I'd like to ask you to consider partnering with me in a way that would continue to do these good works for years to come. It's a simple strategy that can provide 100 million meals, not only this year, but potentially every year for these hungry families in need. It doesn't require a big donation, and the plan I'm proposing offers you the opportunity to change and save lives, literally, by effortlessly giving away your spare change. How? Join me in the campaign to swipe out hunger, swipe out disease, and swipe out slavery. Use your spare change to change the world. So I have an offer for you. My goal in this book was to help you understand the distinctions, the insights, and the skills, and to give you a plan that can truly empower you to create lasting financial security, independence, and freedom for you and your family. I've been obsessed with finding ways to add more value to your life than you could ever imagine in one book, although it's a big one, I do admit. I wanted to inspire you to get beyond scarcity and right now become a wealthy man or woman in this moment. How? It happens the day you start giving with joy in your heart. Wherever you are financially, not because you have to, not because someone has guilted into you or demanded it, but because some part of you is excited to give. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics of the U.S. Department of Labor, there are 124 million households in the U.S. that spend an average of $2,604 a year on entertainment. That's more than $320 billion a year just on entertainment. Now, what are all these numbers about? Imagine if just some of that money went to solving previously intractable problems like hunger or human trafficking, or access to clean water. In the U.S., it takes just $1 to provide up to 10 meals to families in need. Imagine being able to help provide 100 million meals a year. That's a little over $10 million, or just 0.0034% of what we spend on entertainment. It's literally pennies on the dollar of America's pocket change. So here's what I've done. I've partnered with some great minds in business and marketing, including Bob Caruso, a social capitalist who's the former managing partner and COO of one of the top 100 hedge funds in the world, Highbridge Capital Management. And also with my dear friend Mark Benioff, the philanthropist, founder, and the CEO of Salesforce.com, to build a technology that allows you to easily and painlessly put pennies to work to save lives. In less than a minute, you can go online and opt in on Swipeout. You'll find the website at swipeout.com. Then every time you use your credit card anywhere in the world, the price of your purchase will automatically round up to the nearest dollar. That amount will go directly to an approved and effective charity that will report back to you the stories of the lives that you've personally touched, so you're connected. Here's how it works. If you go have a Starbucks and you pay $3.75, the difference between 75 cents and a dollar, the spare change, 25 cents, will be rounded up to the pre-selected charity and sent to them. For an average consumer, that change adds up just to under $20 a month. You can put a limit on it if you want, and we ask that the minimum you allow it to go to is $10. But you want to know what your impact could be for just $20 a month? And by the way, every time you're making a purchase for yourself, you know you're doing good? Well, you could provide 200 meals for hungry Americans. That's 2,400 meals a year. Or you could provide a clean, sustainable source of water for 10 children in India each month. That's 120 children per year that you personally protect from waterborne illness. Or you could make a down payment on rescuing and rehabilitating a young Cambodian girl being trafficked into slavery. These are the three big issues facing children and family. In America, it's hunger, which is why our focus is on swiping out hunger with our partner, Feeding America. But the biggest challenge for children in the world is disease. Did you know that disease caused by contaminated water is the world's leading killer, accounting for 3.4 million deaths per year, according to the World Health Organization? In fact, every 20 seconds, another child dies from a waterborne disease, and more have perished than the total number of people who have died in all the armed conflicts since World War II. And it's all preventable with just simply access to clean water. This is why the second commitment of Swipeout is to swipe out waterborne disease by providing clean water for as many children as possible worldwide. There are a variety of organizations which have sustainable solutions out there, and some require as little as $2 a person to provide these children and their families with a reliable supply of clean water. What's the price of freedom? Throughout this book, we've been working to make sure that you can achieve financial freedom. What about investing just a tiny fraction of what you spend each day or each month to help secure freedom for one of the 8.4 million children in the world who are trapped in slavery? In 2008, ABC News correspondent Dan Harris went undercover to see how long and how much it would take to buy a child slave. He left New York and 10 hours later was in Haiti negotiating to buy a child for, get this, $150. As he said, in the modern world, it costs less to buy a child than an iPod. It would be unimaginable to even consider this happening to our own children or anyone we love, but try to imagine the impact of your actions freeing a human life, a soul that's been enslaved for years, by just contributing your change. There are no words. And once again, you know as you do this that as you sleep, your contribution is empowering those people that are winning this fight every day. So how do we tackle this huge challenge? Each of us together, a little bit at a time, can do it. This year, you and I and a few of our friends can feed 100 million people, but wouldn't it be incredible to feed 100 million people each year in a sustainable way? I personally provide fresh water for 100,000 people a day in India. It's one of my passions. Wouldn't it be amazing to work together and provide 3 million people with clean water a day and maybe grow it from there? How about freeing 5,000 children from being enslaved and supporting their education and their path to a healthy life? That's what the power of just 100,000 of us could do. So just as I built my foundation, this mission can grow geometrically. If over a decade or more we could find a way to grow 1 million members, that'd be 1 billion meals each year. 30 million people with clean water, 50,000 children freed from slavery. Now, these figures are extraordinary, but in truth, if we failed to do any of this and we saved one child's life, it would be worth all the effort, wouldn't it be? So what's your vision? Most people I found overestimate what they can do in a year, and they often underestimate what they can do in a decade or two or three or four. I can tell you, when I first started out on my mission to feed two families, I was excited. And then my goal grew. I wanted to feed 100 families in need, and then grew to 1,000, and then 100,000, and then 1,000,000. The truth is, the more we grow, the more we see what's possible. And really, none of this is going to change by waiting for some multi-billionaire to do it. It's up to you and I. Will you join me? Will you put your change to work? As corny as it sounds, you and I can make a measurable change. Our change can truly change the world. Quote, I've found that among its other benefits, giving liberates the soul of the giver. Maya Angelou. Whether you sign up with Swipe Out right now, and if you want to go there, remember, it's www.swipeout.com, S-W-I-P-E-O-U-T. Or if you make a decision to do something else with another organization, just make sure you make a decision today to take a small portion of the money you earn, nothing that's going to hurt you, or a small portion of your time, and consciously choose to invest it in something that doesn't directly benefit you, but rather goes to someone in greater need. I'm going to tell you something. If you make this decision and you act on it right now, it's going to be a decision you'll look back on years later and you'll be so proud. My dear friend Mark Benioff, when he first started his company, was influenced by some of the philanthropy I've been doing, and he made a cool decision. He said, I'm going to give away 1% of our stock, 1% of our profits, and 1% of our employees' time. It was an easy thing to do at that time. He didn't have a company, he didn't have many employees, and he didn't have much money or stock value. But today, this touched millions of people and supported millions of dollars and millions of man hours. Little decisions that are made at an early stage, even with small amounts of money, can truly grow to make a difference. So my invitation to you is really simple. Just make a decision about doing this, not because you're doing it to be right or wrong, not to look good, just because it's what life's about. Real wealth is that feeling of being alive and being fulfilled that comes whenever we step beyond our own needs. Listen, in Happy Money, Dunn & Norton wrote, when giving outside of ourselves is done right, quote, when it feels like a choice, when it feels like it connects us with others, when it makes a clear impact, even small gifts can increase happiness, potentially stirring a domino effect of generosity. And I'll tell you one more final example. Moved by the potency of what's called pro-social spending, that's the technical term the economists use for this, Dan Ariely and his wife were inspired to put into practice a simple system that frankly inspired me. They do it with their two sons, and they adhere to it together as a family. When they get their kids together for their allowances, they have to divide their money amongst three jars. Jar one is for themselves, the kids for their own money to be able to spend on themselves. Jar two is for somebody they know, and jar three is for somebody they don't know. How cool is that? Notice that two-thirds of these jars are for pro-social spending, because that's what makes these kids happy, and their parents want to instill this in them at the earliest age. All three jars are great, but the Ariely's were careful to set aside an equal portion for people they don't know. Because spending on friends and family is beautiful, because giving to people you love is wonderful, but philanthropy in the third jar can often be the most satisfying and the most important form of giving. I also want to remind you that there's an extraordinarily positive consequence for those who give when, quote, it isn't easy. Because what it does is it primes our brain. It trains and conditions us to know that there is more than enough. And when our brain believes there's more than enough, we experience it. In fact, Sir John Templeton, not only one of the world's greatest investors, but one of the world's greatest human beings, shared something with me almost 30 years ago. He told me that he had never known anyone who had tithed, meaning they gave away 8 to 10% of what they earned to a religious or a charitable organization, for more than 10 years, who didn't massively grow in their financial wealth. And what happened is, by doing it and making it a standard to have more than they needed to help others, they end up having more than they needed for themselves. But here's the problem. Everybody says, you know, well, I'll give when, you know, when I'm doing better. You know, I used to think that way too, so I understand. But I'll testify to you this. You deserve to start wherever you are today. You've got to start the habit of giving, even if you think you're not ready, even if you don't have anything to spare. Why? Because, as I said to you in the very first chapter of this book, if you don't give a dime out of a dollar, you're not about to give 1 million out of 10 million or 10 million out of 100 million. So here's my question. How will you fuel your legacy of giving? Will you give your time, your energy? Will you tithe a portion of your earnings? Or will you start by just taking a minute and going online, sign up for Swipe Out, and have your change become invested in changing lives? If you're really inspired, please do this right now while you're connected to the impact and before you get distracted by emails and your normal daily life. And remember, the person you'll be giving the most to when you make this contribution might well be yourself. Because a life as a philanthropist begins with a single small step. So I'm inviting you to take it with us together. And if not with me or our organization somewhere, do it before you finish this book today. Perhaps even right now. I'll wait. Put me on hold. I can continue. I'm not going away. I don't think of all the misery, but of the beauty that still remains. Anne Frank. By the way, I wasn't always as conscious about the meaning of gratitude and giving. Far from it. I used to live in scarcity. Looking back on my life, it hasn't always been easy, but it has always been blessed. I just didn't recognize it at the time, which is true for many of us. Because I grew up financially poor, I was always working to make sure I could achieve a higher level, but I didn't realize that achievement often comes in spurts. It takes a long time not only to learn something, but to truly master it. And where it becomes ingrained in you, you know what I mean? Where it's part of your life, where you don't have to think about it, where you really produce extraordinary results. So when I was just starting out, I suffered a series of setbacks. How did I react? Well, let's just say not with the grace of an enlightened soul. How's that? I was constantly angry. I was frustrated. I was pissed off because nothing was going my way and I was running out of money. And I had a lot of other people to blame who hadn't helped me and some who'd gotten in my way, I'd felt. And then one night around midnight, I was driving on the 57 freeway from Orange County, California, heading back to a place called Azusa, California. And I got near the Temple Avenue off-ramp near Pomona. Why am I giving these details? I don't know. If you're ever driving there, maybe you'll get hit too. But I started wondering, what's wrong? Why am I working so hard? Really, what's missing from life? Why am I failing so miserably, even though I'm giving my all? You know, why am I getting what I want? What isn't working? And then suddenly, tears started to well up in my eyes. And literally so badly that I pulled over on the side of the freeway. And I just felt a sense of inspiration. I grabbed the journal that I've always carried with me. I've had journals since I was 17 years old. I pulled it out and I took one full page and I started scribbling furiously by the dashboard light. And I wrote in giant letters on a full page this message: the secret to living is giving. As corny as that may sound to you, it hit me in my heart and my soul. I realized, yes, I'd forgotten what life was really about. I'd forgotten that that's where all the joy was found, that life wasn't just about me and whether I was succeeding or failing or whether I was getting what I wanted or not. And when I pulled back on the freeway, I was inspired. Nothing in my life had changed, but everything had. I got refocused. I got reignited. I had a renewed sense of mission, and I started doing really well for a while. But unfortunately, what I'd written that night was just a concept, really. It inspired me. It was an insight, but it wasn't yet fully embodied. It wasn't mastered in me. And gradually, as time went by, I started running into more challenges, and maybe 6 months later, I'd lost everything financially. And before long, I found myself in what I thought was the lowest point of my life. Literally, I was living on the floor of a 400-square-foot bachelor apartment in Venice, California, seething with resentment. I'd fallen in the trap of blaming everybody else for all the natural challenges that show up when you try to go after some really large goals. And I decided that I'd been manipulated by a variety of people who'd taken advantage of me. And if it wasn't for them, my ego said, I'd be in great shape. So I threw myself this big pity party, and I got angrier and more frustrated. I became less and less productive. And pretty much I found myself eating my way into escape. You know, I didn't do drugs, but I used food like a drug. I'd eat this crappy, ridiculous fast food, and I gained over 38 pounds in just a few months. So that's really not easy to do. You got to eat tons of food and not move very much to pull that off. I found myself doing these things that I used to make fun of other people doing, like watching daytime television. If I wasn't eating, I was watching soap operas. I got pulled into the show General Hospital. And if you're old enough, you may remember Luke and Laura Got Married. I was there. It's humorous, and I'd have to say a bit humiliating to look back and see how far I dropped. But I was really down to my last $19 and some change. You know, I found myself in a place where I really had very limited prospects. I didn't know where I was going to get my next meal. And I was really pissed off at a friend who'd borrowed $1,200 from me. And I was, you know, I was doing well at the time. I expected him to pay me back. But now I was broke. Now when I called to get my money back, he just turned his back on me. He wouldn't even return my call. So I was furious thinking, what the hell am I going to do? How am I going to eat? But I've always been pragmatic. And I thought, okay, when I was 17 and my mom kicked my dad out and I was thrown out afterwards and I had to figure out how to survive, what did I do? How'd I get by? I go work my tail off, get a little tiny bit of money, and go to a local smorgasbord and load up on an all-you-could-eat buffet for as little money as possible. And that gave me an idea. My apartment wasn't that far from a beautiful place called Marina Del Rey, where LA's wealthy tend to dock their yachts. There's a restaurant there called El Torito. And it's still there, as a matter of fact, and it has a fabulous buffet for about $6. I didn't want to waste any money on gas or parking, so I thought, you know what? I'm going to just change my state. I'm going to walk the 3 miles or so to the restaurant, and I'm going to sit there right in the marina, and I'm going to load up for the winter, eat all this food, and I look out the window and just dream about, think about how to create a better quality of life. And sure enough, I got there, I ate and I ate and I ate and I watched the boats going by. I got my seconds. I was loading up for the winter, quite literally. And, you know, my feelings started to change. I started looking around and started feeling like, you know what? Layers of anger started melting off me and I started thinking I could change my life. And when I finished my meal, I noticed a small boy open the door and he was dressed in this little suit with a tie and a vest. And he couldn't have been more than, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old. And he opened the door and held it for his mother. And then he proudly led her to the table, and then he held out her chair, and then turned around. I mean, he just, I don't know how to describe it. He had this special presence about him. He was so loving, so kind, so warm to his mom, and it touched me. I don't know. The kid just seemed so pure and so good. He was a giver. You could just feel a giver in this little boy. And you could tell by just the respectful, loving way he treated his mom that you couldn't help but be moved by this boy. So after I paid my check, I walked over to the table and I said to the young man, I said, excuse me. I said, I just wanted to acknowledge you. I said, you are a class act. What an extraordinary gentleman you are. I said, I noticed how you opened the door and held out your seat for your lady. And he said, well, she's my mom. And I said, oh my gosh, that's even cooler. I said, you really are a class act. I said, it's pretty amazing you're taking her to lunch. And he paused in a quiet voice. He said, well, I really can't take her to lunch because I'm just 8 years old and I don't have a job yet. And I said, yes, you are taking her to lunch. And I had no plan. I had not thought of this. And just in that moment, I reached in my pocket and I took what was left. Who knows what it was, $13, $14 and some change, whatever was left after I paid for my other meal. And I said, you're taking her to lunch. And he looked at me shocked with his eyes as big as garbage can covers and a big smile. And he said, well, I can't take that. And I said, of course you can't. And he said, why? I said, you know, because I'm bigger than you are. And I just smiled really big and he grinned from ear to ear. And as he stood there looking at me shocked, I didn't wait. He had a little giggle and I just turned. I didn't even look at his mom. I wasn't doing it for acknowledgement. I just turned and walked out that door. And I got to tell you, I didn't walk out that door. I flew out that door. I mean, you think about it, I should have been freaking out. I mean, I don't have a dime to my name, but instead I felt totally free. That was the day my life changed forever. That was the moment I became a wealthy man. Something inside of me had finally got past that feeling of scarcity. I was finally free of this thing called money that I'd let terrorize me for years. I was able to give everything without fear. Something beyond my mind, something deep in my spirit knew that, I don't know, that I was guided. And it might sound corny, but at that moment, I knew it was meant to be, just like I believe it's meant to be. You're listening to my words right now. And I realized I'd been so busy trying to get that I'd forgotten to give. But now I'd recovered myself. I'd recovered my soul. I went home that night. I had no fear whatsoever. I went to work on a plan. I gave away my excuses and blaming others. And I wasn't angry anymore. I wasn't even frustrated. You know, I might say I wasn't very smart to give all that money away. But there was nothing holding me back. Because I had no idea in hell I was going to go get to the next meal, but I thought, you know, people often go on fasts. I could fast 5 or 6 days. And then I worked on my plan. I felt certain I'd work it all out. Instead of feeling overwhelmed by pain and fear, I felt overwhelming sense of joy. I was released from a nightmare. The nightmare of thinking my life was doomed because of what other people had done to me or because of the lack of money that I had. That night, after I came up with that plan, I slept so deep, and I just felt certain the right things would happen. I'd find a way to make it all work. But you know what? I still didn't know where my next paycheck was going to come from, much less my next meal. And I woke up the next day, and a miracle happened. That next morning, the old traditional snail mail arrived, and I found a special letter in my mailbox. And it was a handwritten note from my friend saying he was so sorry he'd been avoiding my calls. I had been there for him when he needed me. He knew that I was in trouble, so he was paying me back with everything he owed plus a little more. I looked inside the envelope. There was a check for a little over $1,300. It included some change. I don't know why, but it was enough to last me a month or more. I cried. I mean, I was so relieved. And then I asked myself an important question that I think it's important to ask when good things occur. And that is, what does this mean? You know, I don't know if it was coincidence, but I chose in that moment to make it mean that these two events were really connected, that this money had arrived as a reward because I'd really done the right thing, because I'd given unselfishly. There was no plan. I wasn't trying to do it for acknowledgement. I wasn't doing it because I was obligated. I wasn't doing it because I had to or was afraid. I just felt another soul's heart, a young soul on the path, and my heart knew what to do, and I followed through. And I got to tell you, I've had many tough days in my life, economically and emotionally, as we all have. But I have never gone back to that feeling of scarcity that ended that day, and I never will. The ultimate message of this book is pretty simple. It's a sentence I wrote down in my journal on the side of the freeway, a journal I still have to this day. The final secret of wealth is the secret to living is giving. Give freely. Give openly, give easily, give enjoyably, give even when you think you have nothing to give, and you'll discover there's an ocean of abundance inside of you and around you. Life is always happening for you, not to you. Appreciate that gift, and you're wealthy now and forever. Understanding this truth brought me back to what I'm made for, what I believe we're all made for, to be a force for good. I was brought back to a life of deep meaning, constantly looking to fulfill my prayer, and that is each day to be a blessing in the lives of those people I meet and have the privilege to connect with. Even though I may not have met you personally, I wrote this book from that same state. I'm speaking to you from my heart from that same state right now. The state I wrote the book from was asking and praying that each chapter, each concept would somehow be a deeper step in helping you experience more of the blessings of who you are and more of the blessings of what you're able to create and give in this life. My heartfelt wish and the purpose of this book is to give you yet another way to expand and deepen the quality of your life and the lives of those you have the blessings to love and touch. In this, it's been truly a privilege to serve you, and I hope that this will be a time that has inspired you to take your life to another level. And I really look forward to someday hopefully crossing paths with you, either being able to meet you and serve you at one of my events or somewhere in the world, maybe just meeting you on the street. And I'll be excited to hear. I hope you'll come up to me and share with me how you've used these principles to enhance your life. And so, as we part, I want to leave you with a blessing and a wish that your life will forever be filled with abundance. I wish for you a life of joy, passion, challenge, opportunity, growth, and giving. I wish for you an extraordinary life. With love and blessings, Tony Robbins. Live life fully while you're here. Experience everything. Take care of yourself and your friends. Have fun. Be crazy. Be weird. Go out and screw up. You're going to anyway, so you might as well enjoy the process. And take the opportunity to learn from your mistakes. Find the cause of your problem and eliminate it. Don't try to be perfect. Just be an excellent example of being human.
Money, Master the Game, Seven Simple Steps to Financial Freedom was written by Tony Robbins and read by Jeremy Bob and Tony Robbins. It was recorded by Ethan Donaldson at CDM Sound Studios and Simon & Schuster in New York City, and by Rob Norris at Saturn Sound Studios in West Palm Beach. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The associate producer was Madeline Mabee. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. Money, Master the Game was directed and produced by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Money, Master the Game by Tony Robbins is available in print from Simon & Schuster.